between mercy and kindness. Gilliard can school you on the differences later, and yes, I heard about your lesson this morning. I will not argue that Alexander Kerensky showed us no kindness, but it was a mercy that he did not throw us out the palace gates and into the hands of the mob that very first day. It was a mercy that he forced us to work in the garden for months. How? Because there are horrible food shortages in Petrograd right now. He made us grow that food so we would not starve. And yes, in a way, sending us to this swamp at the edge of the world was also his way of showing mercy. Back in July, he knew those Bolshevik buzzards were circling, and he realized that if he did not evacuate us, they would be more than happy to render their own bloody form of justice. So here we are, in a town that is closed off from the rest of the world for 8 months of the year. The river is freezing, and the mud is turning to blocks of ice beneath our feet. We are removed from all civilization, and also from harm, at least for the time being. In his own harsh way, Kerensky helped us in the only way he could.
He could have sent us to England, I say. Father smiles sadly.
But would we have gotten there alive, Schwitzik?
It doesn't matter. None of this matters to me. I won't forgive him, and neither should you. Father still kneels before my brother, so he cannot rise quickly enough to stop me from running from the room.
Schwitzik!
Let her go, Mother says. She has a right to be upset. Upset isn't the right word for what I feel as I stomp through our quarters and up the stairs where the soldiers are housed and out onto the balcony. I am overwhelmed, upended. To hear Father assert that Kerensky had been our protector is insanity. To hear that we no longer have a protector at all is terrifying. It is one of those dismal, overcast days that feels dreary and lethargic. I should have grabbed my coat. I'm still cold from my walk. Or maybe I shouldn't have come at all, but I refuse to go back inside until all evidence of my tears is gone. If I'm going to become a weeper, then I'm determined to do it in private.
Anastasia?
Thomas, of course. What? I wipe my sleeve across my face before I can look at him.
I was in there playing cards when you ripped through the room.
I did not rip.
You did. Girls always rip when they're mad. I thought I'd see if you were okay.
Afraid I might jump from the roof. He takes one step forward, then another. And when he's confident I mean no harm to myself or to him, he sits down beside me.
I don't know. Maybe.
You think I'm really that stupid?
I think you're sad. I don't think anyone else sees it because you try so hard to be brave for them. But it must be really hard to be a prisoner. I'd likely want to pitch myself off a roof too.
I don't want to kill myself, Thomas.
Oh, good.
He throws his arm across his forehead in mock relief.
Because they'd likely make me clean up the mess, and I'm no good with blood.
I don't laugh so much as snort. But entrails are acceptable. He shrugs.
I draw the line at blood and vomit.
Maria needled me about my friendship with Thomas, but he is easy to talk to, and he makes me laugh. I never feel stupid or ugly or invisible when I'm around him. Thomas sees me, and Jimmy likes him more and more every day. I have always believed dogs to be wonderful judges of character. Thomas stretches his legs out in front of him.
What are you doing then? Since you're not up here to go tumbling over the rail?
I don't know what makes me tell him the truth. Maybe I'm wrung out emotionally. Maybe I am desperate. Maybe I like him. Liking a boy can do strange things to the mind. Thinking, I whisper.
About?
Escape. No sooner is the word out of my mouth than I realize what a terrible mistake I've made. Thomas isn't my friend. He can't ever really be my friend. His job is to make sure we don't escape. He must recognize the look of terror on my face, because he is quick to ask,
"Is that a secret?"
I nod like an imbecile. He pulls at the long, straight bone in the bridge of his nose. good thing you know how I feel about keeping secrets.
Chapter 15. Anna. The Grand Enor Corporation. 1929-1928. Metropolitan Opera House, New York City, November 1929. The playbill announces that tonight's performance is Tosca, the famed Italian opera by Giacomo Puccini. They sit in the heiress's private box, to the right of the stage, and the seats below are filling up quickly with theatre-goers in their evening finest. Below them is a sea of bow ties and feather boas, fur coats, cufflinks, and lit cigars. The buzz of human chatter contrasts starkly with the occasional outburst of tuning from the orchestra. A handful of patrons have noticed their presence in the box, and they gawk, pointing and lifting their chins in an effort to share the sighting with their companions. Anna keeps her gaze fixed on the empty stage. She's cold, but doesn't dare drape her wrap around her shoulders again. The heiress objected to her wearing it in the first place, so impressed was she with the Madeleine Vionnet gown Anna has chosen for tonight. The dress is a masterpiece. It is a beaded cream silk, a slight departure from her standard white. It boasts thin straps and an open back, and goose flesh has risen all along her arms from the chill. Cut on the bias, the dress has the magical properties of making Anna look exceedingly more glamorous and 6 inches taller than she really is, a thing she greatly appreciates now that she's in her 30s and is starting to notice the effects of time. "I am glad to see," the heiress whispers in her ear, "that the recent financial debacle has not thinned the crowd. It would be such a shame on opening night." For 2 weeks, the heiress has been obsessed with the stock market crash and all the news surrounding it. They call it Black Tuesday, and every morning the papers report some new tragedy. Lives lost, institutions ruined, families bankrupted. Her host follows it with religious zeal, in much the same way she scours the society pages for news and insists on reporting the salacious details over breakfast. Anna stayed in her room this morning to avoid it altogether, excusing herself by claiming exhaustion, when in reality she no longer had the stomach for every tawdry detail. Loss is loss, and death is death, and everyone in this city is so surprised to learn of the existence of either. The heiress, however, has missed her daily dispensing of gossip and won't be so easily thwarted. "Do you remember John Hammond?" she asks. Anna knows better than to answer, but it would be rude not to. She chooses a lie instead of the rather complicated truth. "I don't believe so, no. He was that handsome young banker who joined us on the yacht this summer." "Oh, yes," Anna says. "A charming man." She drops her gaze to her lap, and this movement does not go unnoticed by the heiress. "I've been told he jumped out of the 12th-floor window of the Bank of the United States on Black Tuesday. Lost everything, they say, was ruined by a particularly bad investment. Such a shame. He was a lovely young man. He had a bright future ahead of him." Anna looks straight ahead now, unmoving, unwilling to betray her emotions or return the meaningful glance the heiress directs her way. "John Hammond took his life because of a bad investment." She refuses to cry or give way to the explosive sense of guilt that rattles around the back of her skull when the heiress adds, "I rather thought he took a shine to you." The lights dim, and the cacophony in the orchestra pit grows more urgent and intentional. The buzz of human voices lessens to a murmur as the crimson swathe of velvet curtain rustles with some movement backstage. Quiet laughter in the box next to them. The crackle of paper as the heiress inspects her playbill for the names of familiar singers. "Oh, God, please don't let her drag me backstage afterward," Anna thinks. "I cannot be put on display tonight, not now." Anna can hear the blood rushing through her ears with each beat of her heart. Her hands remain where she left them, folded in her lap. Her eyes blink furiously, pushing away the unwanted emotions. It is only at intermission that Anna finally relaxes enough to clap with the rest of the crowd, but she does not retreat to the lobby with the heiress, insisting that women's troubles have left her feeling poorly this evening. Not even Annie Burr Jennings, decades removed from her childbearing years, can argue with that. The moment she's alone, Anna pulls the wrap around her shoulders and draws into herself, eyes closed, desperate to become master of her own emotions again. She tries to assure herself that John Hammond's death is not her fault. And then the heiress returns, and the curtains are pulled back once more, and the stage fills with opera singers performing Puccini's classic saga of torment and murder and suicide, all wrapped in the reverberating sound of his legendary melodic arias. Suicide. 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 A theme, it seems, she cannot escape in life or theatre. Anna survived her own attempt, but it seems not everyone is as fortunate as she. A memory surfaces. John Hammond, naked, in the starlight. There is a darkness that creeps into Anna's peripheral vision, the harbinger of her old nemesis, that creeping, desperate panic whose grip has been loosened only in recent years. But now that it has arrived, there is no keeping it at bay. Her only choice is whether or not to surrender in the company of others. "If you will excuse me," Anna says, rising to her feet and drawing the wrap tighter around her shoulders. "I think I'm going to be ill." 4 months earlier. Sconset Beach, Nantucket Island. July 1929. It is midnight, and the sky is clear, but the only light that reaches the sleek, spacious yacht comes from the stars, for the moon has waned to a mere sliver. The heiress has gone to bed in her cabin below, as have a small handful of guests, and the boat lies still and placid in the water, anchored several hundred yards from shore. Anna is alone on deck with a gentleman, some banker from Manhattan, and she's had enough champagne to have forgotten his last name, John something or other. Not enough to fall down drunk, but certainly enough to lose her typical buttoned-up demeanour. And speaking of buttons, several of hers seem to be missing. No, not missing. Undone. Funny, she has no idea how it happened.
"Oh, don't get shy on me now," the banker says when she moves to slip the little mother-of-pearl buttons back through their holes. "It's just a bit of fun. No harm intended. The water's warm. We should go for a swim."
His shoes are off, as are his socks, and at this pronouncement, the banker takes a swig of champagne right from the bottle and unbuttons his own shirt. The man has reason to be confident, and Anna struggles not to stare.
"Your turn," he says, handing her the bottle with an aggressively charming smile. "Double dog dare you."
"I don't think..."
"I promise I don't bite," he says, flashing those lovely white teeth, "unless you want me to."
Anna cannot remember the last time she felt heat like this in her belly, the last time a man looked at her like that, not as a threat or a claim, but as a challenge, an invitation. It feels good, and Anna lifts the bottle to her lips. She lets the fizzy liquid settle on her tongue, and then swallows a mouthful of courage, and then another. Anna has found her drug of choice, and it comes corked in a bottle with 1,000 tiny bubbles that tickle her nose. Champagne. Nectar of the gods. She swigs again, deeply. The wonderful thing, she decides, tipping the last of it into her mouth, is that you never feel it coming. She has never been a heavy drinker, and abhors most hard liquor, can't stand the harsh, burning fire in her throat, the feel of a million suns on her tongue. But this is different. Special, sweet, even better than pear cider. And it ever so easily lifts her mood and strips her inhibitions away. Before she knows it, her white silk blouse comes off, revealing a thin chemise with no bra underneath. The heiress assured her this was the fashion, and she stands there, uncertain what to do next. The banker whoops in approval and drops his trousers to the deck. The ridiculous man knows he's worth looking at because he does not break eye contact while he loses the one remaining garment on his body.
Then he steps to the deck rail, all long and silver in the starlight, and swan dives over the edge. She's at the rail quickly enough to catch part of a splash on her face. The boat rocks gently with their movements, and her stomach roils in response. When the heiress suggested they go boating earlier in the evening, Anna was terrified she'd spend the entire trip below decks, holding a bucket in her lap. Thankfully, her host's idea of boating was simply to drop anchor several hundred yards offshore and throw a party on the deck. That's easy enough to live with if she doesn't think about it too hard. "Jump in!" the banker shouts as he sends a spray of water onto the deck. This stranger, this man she has known for less than 12 hours, beckons her with that muscled arm. Anna considers her scars, what he will think if he sees them. But it is dark, the champagne is going to her head, and for once she doesn't care. "Don't leave me hanging, pretty lady," he shouts off the starboard side. Surely he's far enough away. Surely in the dim light he won't be able to see the wreckage of her body. "Look away," Anna orders. "I think you're missing the point of this little exercise, madam." He laughs, long and seductive, and Anna lifts the hem of her chemise without even realizing. "But if you insist, I'll turn around." The rest of her clothing joins his in a pile on the deck. She's unsure if this is an act of bravery or stupidity, but she goes over the rail anyway, feet first, with a graceless splash. Anna isn't sure how he defines warm water, but to her this doesn't qualify. It's cool enough to shock her into full sobriety, and she treads water a little faster than necessary to stay warm. The banker is at her side in moments, and they stare at each other, their bare shoulders bobbing above the water.
"That wasn't so bad, was it?" he asks.
"I think I'll survive." And then she feels a warm hand on the cool skin of her waist as he pulls her closer. The press of full, confident lips against her own. His voice only a murmur.
"Life is too short, madam, for that kind of attitude. Who wants to just survive? Wouldn't you rather live?"
"Some of us don't have the luxury of that choice," Anna thinks. But then she is lost in the other urgent questions the banker is asking with his hands. 6 months earlier. Law Office of Edward Fallows, Long Island, New York. January 1929.
"You want me to do what?"
Anna says, utterly baffled, when Edward Fallows slides the papers across his desk for her to sign. "Form a corporation," he answers, as though it's nothing more complicated than baking a loaf of bread.
"Why?"
"To raise money for your cause, of course. We suspect the Romanov family will soon take their argument to the courts, and you will need funds to defend yourself." Edward Fallows fiddles with the pen on his desk.
"As you know, I continue to work without retainer, but there are other costs to consider. Research, travel, appeals. All of these things require funds, and the Grandinor Corporation allows us to raise these funds on your behalf."
"Grandinor?"
"Gleb and I came up with the name. It's an acronym for Grand Duchess Anastasia Nikolaevna of Russia. You will be happy to know that we sent letters to all of Miss Jennings' friends inviting them to invest."
It is a staggering act of hubris, and a quiver of rage creeps into her voice.
"How could you do that without even consulting me first?"
Fallows and Gleb exchange a look, and Gleb holds out a hand to him in warning. "Let me handle this," the gesture says. He turns to Anna.
"My dear, that's what a power of attorney does. It allows him to act on your behalf in legal situations. You signed it months ago, remember?"
"Of course I remember. I'm not an idiot."
"Then help me understand why you're so angry."
"Because I wasn't even asked. You just went and did this without so much as a word."
"And how else did you expect us to acquire the means of support for you?"
"Miss Jennings is my sponsor now. She has assured me that everything will be taken care of."
Gleb smiles the way he would at a child who believes the sun can be hers if she only asks nicely enough. "Yes, she's graciously covering all your living expenses, and then some."
Gleb hazards a glance at the lavish gold watch that circles her left wrist. But your legal fees remain your own.
Don't do that, Anna says.
Do what?
Treat me like an infant. I'm not stupid, you know. I can follow along. But you always run off and do these things. You come up with these plans, and half the time they only make things worse.
I am trying to help you. That's all I've ever done.
Then help me by explaining what this Grand Donor Corporation is, and then allow me the right to have an opinion, even if you don't like it.
Gleb takes a deep breath, and she can see him wrestle his anger down a notch. It is true that he has worked tirelessly on her behalf, but it is also true that his eagerness has complicated matters on more than one occasion.
Of course, he says finally, Mr. Fallows will explain the plan, and I think you'll find it rather ingenious.
The concept is ambitious, if legally questionable, and Anna cannot help but admire the simplicity of it. A select group of investors, carefully culled from Annie Burr Jennings's social circle, were invited to subscribe to the Grand Donor Corporation. In exchange for their investment, they will receive 5 times their original amount when Anastasia's inheritance is awarded. Mr. Fallows, of course, will receive 1/4 of the total monies, and the rest will go to Anastasia. Gleb has asked for nothing.
This will never work, Anna groans. You've made a fool of me.
Fallows shakes his head.
But it is working. Quite well, in fact. 3 of Miss Jennings's friends have already subscribed. Their checks have been deposited and are earning interest in an account at the Bank of the United States as we speak. This opportunity appeals to the younger set in particular. They appreciate a good opportunity, especially with the financial markets being so uneasy right now. Your first subscriber was a young man in his 20s, John Hammond, a banker on Wall Street.
Fallows inches the paper closer to her and sets a pen on top of them.
All you have to do in order to make it official is sign.
And so, against her better judgment, she does. 1 month earlier. The Ritz-Carlton, Manhattan. December 1928.
You, my dear, are a social find of the highest order.
The heiress lays one cool hand on top of Anna's. It is loaded with rings and soft with expensive lotion. Annie Burr Jennings is older, at the latter end of 70, perhaps, though she doesn't look a day over 60, and is happily unmarried. A spinster, they would call her if she lived anywhere other than the glittering center of Manhattan, where wealth and excess are worshipped above a woman's fertility and marital status. They are seated in the center of the Ritz-Carlton dining room, at a table that once belonged to Miss Jennings's father, a director of the original Standard Oil Trust. She is his sole heir. The smile she turns on Anna is feline and hungry. Anna pulls her hand away the moment she thinks it's safe to do so without causing offense. The restaurant is on the 15th floor, with stunning views of the city in every direction. The room is banked by windows, but an occasional stretch of richly paneled wall is visible, giving the space both an airy and an opulent feel. It is decorated for Christmas, and the boughs of greenery and swags of red ribbon contrast nicely with the crisp white tablecloths, the polished silver and gleaming crystal. Waiters in tuxedos with ironed napkins hanging over their forearms. And here they are, seated right in the middle, Anna in her simple white dress and the heiress in her finery. Anna cannot shrink far enough from the woman's ravenous gaze, so she drops both hands into her lap and laces her fingers together lest they be clutched again.
"I'm sorry," she says finally. "I don't understand what you mean."
"Goodness, I've frightened you."
The heiress is amazed, as though such a thing never occurred to her.
"I don't bite, dear girl. You needn't be worried. I only mean to help. You seemed a little puzzled about why I would offer my home to a total stranger. I was simply explaining that you, a genuine Russian princess, are the equivalent to a social gold mine."
"So you've invited me into your home to show me off? Like some exhibit at the zoo?"
Do you plan on charging admission as well? The heiress frowns and clears her throat as though trying to erase the insult. Do you know who I am? She asks. Probably as much as you know who I am. There, I knew we spoke the same language. Let's just say we're both a kind of royalty. And one does not leave one's friend, may I use that word, I do hope we will become friends, out in the cold. So when I heard that you had broken company with Xenia Leeds, I thought it only right to extend an invitation of my own. My home is your home for as long as you wish to stay. Anna has had offers like this far too often, and she has learned not to trust them. She has grown wiser than her 32 years would suggest. In exchange for what? Your company. Nothing else. I wish you to be my companion. Oh, I see. I'm afraid you are under a misapprehension, Anna says. Whatever you have heard about me is wrong. I do not go in for... I mean that I am not interested in... There are no polite words to express her meaning, so she lets her words trail off altogether, blushing furiously, unable to make the necessary awkward clarification. Annie Burr Jennings, heiress of legendary proportions, laughs so loudly that the entire dining room turns to look at the two of them. It is a mercy when she whispers her reply. I do not go in for the sapphic arts, if that is what you fear. Truth be told, I am too aged for arts of any kind. Yes, I know, I do not look my years, but that is only because I have good genes and expensive night cream at my disposal. I've also been known to bathe in the blood of virgins occasionally to keep the skin supple. She laughs again at Anna's look of horror. That is an Elizabeth Bathory reference, by the way. Oh, never mind, I see you don't take my meaning. Let me be clear, I am not interested in your... She waves a hand in Anna's general direction. Person. I only wish for you to accompany me around town so that I can liven things up a bit. New York has gone dreadfully dull in the last few years. That is all? I'm afraid so. I have no children, an empty penthouse, and more money than I can spend on this side of eternity. Half of the people in this city would be falling all over themselves to accept such a deal. I fear that I don't have much in common with either half of the city. And that is exactly why I extended the offer to you. Look around, my dear. You've already drawn attention. She leans back in her seat and lifts her tea to her lips. She takes a demure sip. And it feels good, doesn't it? Anna's smile draws looks from across the room. Yet she is still hesitant. But isn't it gauche to trade on my name? Again that delighted laugh. Don't be naive, my dear. Every woman trades on something. Beauty is easy enough to come by. So is charm. On my block, wealthy women are a dime a dozen. Talent won't set you apart. Neither will intelligence or tenacity or ruthless ambition. Not in this city. But royalty? Now that's something special. So you need to ask yourself one question. If none of those other women are ashamed to trade on what they've been given, why should you be? 2 months earlier. Garden City, New York. October 1928. How is it possible? Gleb asks, his left eyebrow crimped into an expression of complete bafflement, that a picture of your great-great-great-grandmother hangs above your head and you do not even recognize it. Anna lobs a small pillow at him in aggravation. Ridiculous man, always fussing about insignificant details. Ridiculous, yes, but also loyal and sweet beyond reason. He has not changed in that regard at all. Yet she has more important things to worry about at the moment than Gleb's finer qualities, not the least of which is the fact that she is homeless once again. Her situation is not helped by the fact that the Romanov family has now publicly accused her of being a fraud. The scathing statement was printed in every major newspaper around the globe, and as a result, her pool of supporters has gone dry. Gleb read the statement to her over dinner last week, and she still hates the fact that a group of scattered royalty on the other side of the Atlantic would make her cry in public. Anna now sits at a small desk beside the window in her room, gazing at the uninspiring view. The busy two-lane road and supermarket across the street do little to improve her mood. If it were not for the birds chirping in their cage in the corner, she might despair entirely. The fact that Xenia Leeds allowed her to keep them after Anna's hasty departure was unexpected, but not unappreciated.
"Oh, good grief," she finally says. "Would you recognize a painting of your great-great-great-grandmother if you saw it hanging on the wall in a random hotel room?"
"My grandmother is not Queen Louise of Prussia." Anna is tempted to throw something else at him, but decides to sort through a pile of mail instead. Since leaving Kenwood, everything has been forwarded to this second-rate motel. "Consider yourself lucky. I hear she was a proper bitch." Gleb winces at the profanity. He objects to her use of such language categorically, but today decides to pick on her oversight instead. "You should have recognized her. It's the sort of mistake your detractors will use against you," he says. "They are looking for any small detail to delegitimize your claim."
"And you think a painting will do me in?"
"I think you need to be careful." Anna lifts the paper knife in her hand. The blade is silver and comes to a fine point. The handle is mother of pearl and bears the crest of Empress Alexandra. It has been in Anna's possession for many years, and it's one of the few things she brings with her every time she moves.
"Have you ever seen this paper knife before?"
she asks, holding it up by the blade. He looks at it as though she has thrust a hairpin into his face or a pair of chopsticks or some other irrelevant thing.
"No."
"What?" Anna gasps in mock outrage. "If you were truly Gleb Botkin, you would know this paper knife was once in the possession of your sister. But clearly you are a fraud. I shall send you to Pierre Gilliard for interrogation."
"You're being ridiculous."
"And you are being a jackass."
"Such language, and you call yourself a princess."
"I call myself exhausted and overwhelmed and homeless for the third time in a year. I think I'm entitled to a bit of profanity under the circumstances.
Or do you think princesses don't learn to curse like the rest of humanity?"
"I think they have the good sense not to do so, especially when the eyes of the world are upon them." He drops into the chair by the bed in a huff. "Besides, you aren't homeless. You have a room in this lovely hotel for several weeks, and Rachmaninoff to thank for it." "So the composer has taken a turn at the till, has he?"
Anna met Sergei Rachmaninoff a number of times during her stay with Xenia Leeds, but never really knew why he wanted to help.
"He's a loyalist, feels it's the least he can do."
"And when his generosity runs out, what then?"
"Rachmaninoff is arranging a meeting with some heiress in New York. She's in Paris at the moment, but he expects her to return before Christmas."
"It is impossible to live like this, bounced around constantly. It feels as though I'm losing my mind, like I am dislocated, shifting constantly from one place to the next. Why can't I just live with you?"
Anna regrets the words the moment they're out. This is a subject they staunchly avoid. Gleb turns red, then stares at his hands.
"If I thought for a moment you actually wanted that, I might consider it."
He glances up and offers a half-smile.
"It's better this way. We just need a little bit more time. Edward Fallows has come up with an idea, and I think it could work. We just need..."
"What?"
He clears his throat and does his best to keep a straight face when he answers.
"For you to sign power of attorney over to Edward Fallows."
"Oh, is that all?"
"No," he says. "We also need money."
Chapter 16. Anastasia. Christmas in Siberia. 1917-1918. Tobolsk, Russia. December 24, 1917. For most of my life, I pictured Siberia in winter as a bleak, barren landscape of ashen sky and blanched earth, with the occasional spindly, leafless tree breaking up the monotony. The reality, however, is rather different. Although ferociously cold the first few weeks in December, the snowfall is light and is quickly blown away by the relentless wind or packed by foot traffic in the streets. Our days take on a pattern of frost, thaw, sunshine, and darkness. They are painfully short, often over before we have the chance to enjoy them, and we never really get warm despite our layers of clothes and the fires that burn constantly in every hearth of the governor's house. It is not uncommon for the sun to set at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and we spend much of our lives in darkness, blinking at one another in the dim light of sputtering lanterns. Father continues reading to us at night, but when his voice grows hoarse, he pulls out his maps and studies train routes with Pierre Gilliard. The rest of us continue our needlework. Every corset, coat, camisole, belt, and hat, anything with a seam, is ripped open and lined with jewels from the cache in Mother's trunks. Our underclothes, once light and soft, take on an uncomfortable weight and stiffness. And through it all, I begin to wonder, to hope, that some plan of escape is being formed. I daydream about rescue, building fantasies in my mind that rival the plot of Ivanhoe. They are foolish, romantic, impossible fantasies, and I share them with no one, not even Thomas. This, I admit only to myself, is because he's in many of them. We've grown so used to containment, to being locked within the walls and yard of the governor's house, that none of us really knows what to say when they finally let us out on Christmas Eve. We stare at Leshy, wondering if it is a trick, some cruel bit of entertainment on his part. Those strange animal eyes of his show no signs of deception.
"We can leave?"
Father asks, his voice pitched a note higher in disbelief.
"No,"
Leshy shakes his head.
"You may go to the candlelight service at the Blagoveshchensky Church in town. You'll be under armed guard, and you will return here immediately afterward. I am allowing an excursion, not an exodus."
Father, now suspicious, asks, "Why?" Leshy shrugs, but I see a softening in his face, some bit of humanity he tries so hard to keep hidden.
"Because it is Christmas."
So we change into what little finery we brought with us. White kidskin boots, petticoats, and dresses of rough silk with straight, simple lines in various shades of grey and taupe. Only a year ago, we might have worn them to walk in the woods or tend the garden. We would have thought them plain and ugly, day dresses. But now, as I run calloused fingers along the elegant fabric, they seem elaborate, an embarrassment of riches. We braid our hair, pinch our cheeks for colour, and dig through our drawers until we find the bottle of perfume that Maria smuggled into her trunk. We dab drops of the decadent scent behind our ears, and, after primping the best we can, present ourselves in the study. We must, finally, look the part of royalty, because the guards, Thomas and Ivan in particular, smile stupidly as we pass. There is a fine dusting of snow on the boardwalk when we leave the house bundled in our furs. We are joined by the staff, along with Gleb and Tanya Botkin, and surrounded by guards, Semyon and Leshy in front and five others behind. I listen as Thomas and Ivan whisper about the change in weather. I can sense no difference in the cold, pewter sky and frozen air, but these men know that winter has turned a corner and is about to become more sinister. By the time we reach the broad stone steps of the church, it is snowing heavily, the ground littered with large, thick flakes. I've been dragged to church by Mother all of my life. The haunting sound of a choir, the smooth wood of a pew, and the worn fabric of a prayer bench are as familiar to me as the feel of my own sheets. Communion, prayer, liturgy, all of these things are second language I speak fluently. Yet I love none of it the way I love a Christmas Eve service. The candles and the incense, the greenery and hymns. It is different, somehow. holy. We file into the church behind the offices and look for empty seats. The sanctuary is almost full, and the moment that gust of cold air sweeps into the room, flickering the candles and ruffling the pages of hymnals, the entire congregation turns to note the interruption. And they know. If the plan was to avoid detection, we fail miserably. So we quietly slide into several empty pews near the back and turn our eyes to the hymnals. But according to custom, we do not sit. This service, along with most others in the Russian Orthodox Church, is performed standing. The whispering begins as a rustle and grows until it nearly drowns out the choir. Leshy and Semyon go rigid before us. From the corner of my eye, I can see Thomas brave a worried glance in my direction. We pull into the shadows, eyes downcast, hands gripping our hymnals. We make no eye contact. We acknowledge no one. Eventually, the congregants turn their attention back toward the front. But I can see their rigid backs, their chins angled slightly to the side, as though they might catch a glimpse of us if they turn their heads just so. The service is filled with haunting melodies, incense, scripture readings, candlelight, and reverent liturgy. After the priest says, "Let us complete our prayers to the Lord," he lifts his face toward the back of the chapel where we stand. Leshy draws in a sharp breath, and Semyon curses when the priest begins reciting the Monogaletia, a prayer of long life for the imperial family. With each word, his voice rises, echoing off the stone walls and the arched wooden ceiling. The prayer is eloquent and lovely and the most dangerous thing he could possibly utter. Because that priest, that devout, foolish, idiotic man, recites, in painful, excruciating detail, each of our imperial titles as he prays. Tsar Nicholas II, Emperor of all Russia. Alexandra Fedorovna, Empress of all Russia. Grand Duchess Olga Nikolaevna. Grand Duchess Tatiana Nikolaevna. Grand Duchess Maria Nikolaevna. Grand Duchess Anastasia Nikolaevna. Alexei Nikolaevich, Tsarevich of all Russia. Each word lands like the blow of a hammer in that deathly quiet sanctuary. Each title sounds more preposterous and arrogant than the next. The congregation stares at us brazenly now, half of them with open hostility, and the other half with an alarming sort of reverence. The priest himself stands with eyes closed and arms lifted, as though in worship to us. It doesn't take long for Leshy and Semyon to hustle us from the church. I can still hear the last words of the prayer echoing through the room as the doors slam closed behind us. "I had nothing to do with that," Father says when Leshy turns on him with a look of rage.
"It doesn't matter. That fool declared you to be his sovereign before the entire congregation. Home, now," Leshy says, turning the collar of his coat up to block the wind.
The big fat snowflakes from earlier have become tiny projectiles that bite our cheeks and sting our noses.
"I should have known better than to take you out in public. It will never happen again."
"It shouldn't have happened to start with," Semyon growls. "You've made them objects of worship."
"No," Leshy says. "I have made them targets."
"You are being ridiculous," Father says.
Leshy steps forward, grabs the front of Father's coat, and shakes him so hard his jaw clenches.
"Don't you understand, you stupid man, you asinine, entitled fool? The Bolshevik cancer creeps closer every day. Just this morning I got a telegram that the Workers' Soviet in Tomsk is demanding that your entire family be handed over and put in prison. Not in a palace, not in a comfortable governor's house, but in a prison. A rotting, filthy, piss-covered prison. And that should frighten you."
He shakes Father again, harder this time. I take an involuntary step backward at the guttural sound of Leshy's voice and bump into Thomas. I feel his hand at my waist, steadying me, and then he pulls it away. But not before Gleb, lips pinched together in disapproval, notices the glancing touch. I ease away from Thomas.
"You may hate it here. You may hate me," Leshy continues.
But the mercy I extend in this frozen outpost is the only thing standing between you and a misery you cannot imagine. Kerensky knew this, and now he's running for his life.
Breathless and enraged, Leshy finally lets go of Father and steps back. He motions for the guards to lead us toward the governor's house, and we march home in the growing snowstorm without speaking a word. Semyon brings up the rear, and when I look at him, there is murder in his eyes. I should be afraid. I should scamper away. But mostly, I want to cram the toe of my boot directly into that gap between his teeth. We stomp through the front door half an hour later, cold, miserable, and subdued after wishing Botkin and his children farewell and a Merry Christmas. The guards disperse to the second floor, and my family retreats to Father's study. "Is it true, what Leshy said?" I ask. I watch as Father builds a fire in the hearth, and Olga lights the candles on the Christmas tree that Thomas and Ivan cut in the hills behind the house last week. I wait for his answer. Finally, he says,
"Yes, the Bolsheviks have wrested power from Alexander Kerensky. But we are secure in this distant exile, at least until the spring thaw. Tobolsk is separated from the rest of the world for half the year. A river made of ice renders travel impossible, and we will find a way out of here long before then."
Father kisses the top of my head.
"It is late. Let us have dinner and then go to bed."
But I am unwilling to let Christmas slip away just yet. I pull Alexei aside. He looks at me with those pleading, wide blue eyes, his face pale, and I know he is desperate for some measure of hope and cheer as well. I lean closer and make him an offer no young boy can refuse.
"How would you like to play with fire?" I ask.
The upstairs Christmas tree, when lit, is spectacular. Thomas and Ivan dragged the fat-bottomed balsamic firs into the house a week ago. We set one in Father's study and the other upstairs in the soldiers' quarters. They smell of cloves and oranges and pungent sap and are decorated with a measly assortment of ribbons, pine cones, candles, and beads. They are beautiful. One by one, our guards gather upstairs, and their expressions turn from gloom to wonder. Scowls became smiles. Hunched shoulders relax, and furrowed brows smooth into joy. I can see memories dancing in their eyes, bits and pieces of their own beloved Christmases past, reflected in the candlelight. I see Thomas on the other side of the tree staring at me, and I cannot help but smile. The only other person who looks at me like that is Gleb Botkin, and I suddenly feel guilty for reasons I can't explain. He would be furious to see me smile at Thomas like this.
"Merry Christmas!"
Alexei shouts, and the guards cheer. Thomas steps around the tree and hoists my brother onto his shoulders. He runs in circles around the tree, singing "O Tannenbaum" loudly and off-key, but with great enthusiasm. And then my parents and sisters come upstairs, their arms full of packages filled with bookmarks, knitted caps, stockings, scarves, our small handmade gifts for these men. All the while the dogs run in circles around us, barking happily and licking the hands of anyone who stoops to pet them. My gift to Thomas is a card with a hand-painted rooster. He takes it and laughs. I think that if we weren't surrounded by so many others, he might hug me as well. Perhaps he might do something more. "Thank you," Thomas whispers, and I go completely still as his thumb brushes the back of my hand.
"What is this?"
Semyon's hard, angry voice demands from the doorway behind us. Thomas and I spring apart like we've been shocked. Semyon's eyes are on the tree, however, and the bits of wrapping paper strewn across the floor.
"It is Christmas," Father says.
"Get out, all of you. Prisoners are not allowed on the second floor."
7 weeks later. Tobolsk, Russia. February 14th, 1918. Winter meets us, finally, with a savage drop in temperature that confirms everything we've heard about this distant, frozen tundra. This new cold is nothing less than a crucifixion of the soul, and the snow that began on Christmas Eve still remains at Valentine's Day, covered by 2 additional feet. Father, restless and angry, has shoveled paths through the yard so we can reach the chicken coop and the refuse pit. He has spent countless hours tossing huge shovelfuls of snow into the middle of the yard so he can maintain his daily walks. Whether he intended it or not, that pile has grown into a small mountain that Alexei now claims as his own. It doesn't take my brother long to realize that if he climbs to the top and sits on top of a trash lid, he can slide to the bottom with frightening speed. And so it is that on February 14th, 1918, the day the Russian calendar changes to the Gregorian calendar, I sit with Alexei on the snow pile and watch a company of Red Guards march across the frozen river and approach the house. They advance upon us like a horde of spiders, long-limbed and purposeful. I find myself struggling to breathe, as though there's a hand at my throat. When I turn to Alexei, he too is stricken with terror, his mouth open, his eyes wide. We scramble down the snow heap at once and bolt toward the house, without exchanging a word. Father bursts through the kitchen door just as we enter. "To the study," he demands, "all of you." And then he tells us in rushed, breathless sentences what Alexei and I have already seen. We hear shouting and stomping at the front door. We hear boots in the hall. "But how?" I ask. "You said the boats wouldn't be able to pass for months. You said we were safe."
"I was wrong," he says, pained. "They must have come by wagon and walked across."
"What happens now?"
"We stay close together at all times and trust none of them."
And then the door to Father's study swings open. The man who stands there looks as though he has been swallowed by his own clothing. He is all wire and tendon, cinched in the middle by a thick leather belt. His skin is olive, his hair is black, his eyes are small, dark, and deep-set. When he steps into the room, I think he looks like a vulture, like he could happily pick us to shreds. What I do not expect is his voice, a deep boom that fills the air and demands immediate attention.
"My name is Yakov Yurovsky," he says, "and I have come to take command of this garrison."
He looks around the small study, at the bookshelves and rug, at the chairs and writing desk, all small comforts we've brought with us from Tsarskoye Selo. He holds his hands out to the cheerfully popping fire, standing there for several minutes, letting his fingers warm until he finally says,
"It is time you were brought to justice."
Chapter 17. Anna. The Root of All Evil. 1928. Kenwood Estate, Oyster Bay, New York. July 1928. It takes 6 months for Anna to convince Xenia Leeds that she is Grand Duchess Anastasia Romanov. Her host is kind but naturally suspicious. Instead of pressing Anna with questions, Xenia waits patiently for any signs of fraud. She cares little for the grandiose stories her other guests ask Anna to tell. Sergei Rachmaninoff, the famous composer, wants to hear escapades of the Russian court and exploits of the Tsar. He has come to visit Anna several times during her stay, is always magnanimous, showing deference to the point of worship. Xenia tolerates this behavior, but from a distance and with misgiving. She is always watching, always waiting. The tests she gives Anna are more subtle and harder to pass. Xenia observes how she folds her napkin in her lap, mounts a horse, crosses her ankles, and cuts her fillet. Xenia listens to the inflection of her voice when she says certain words, notes Anna's diction and accent. The way she carries herself, her posture and gait when walking through a room, the way she holds a teacup, how a full curtsy means one thing and a partial curtsy means something else entirely. Unlike the other skeptics Anna has met through the years, Xenia Leeds is intimately acquainted with the small manners of the Russian court. She is, after all, a Romanov cousin and princess in her own right. Anna feels those dark, noble eyes on her constantly, searching for the truth. Some days Anna cannot bear the weight of them, and she retreats to her suite, leaving Xenia to her husband, William, and young daughter Nancy in their opulent surroundings. William is laughably American in his looks, sandy hair, bright blue eyes, broad white smile, and, to add insult to injury, is tall, tan, well-built, and so handsome as to be distracting. He looks like he might have come directly from California, or perhaps from the loins of Zeus. Anna is only a breath past 30, but she feels ancient, exhausted beneath the weight of the Leeds' scrutiny, strained from trying to live up to their expectations. "Why don't you speak Russian?" Xenia asks one afternoon in early July. She has entered Anna's suite, wearing her tennis whites, and watches curiously as Anna feeds two green parrots from the end of her fork. Their little hooked beaks pick delicately at pieces of cut apple, and they squawk happily, perched on her forearm. "I do speak Russian. You heard me just now as you stood in the door." Xenia blushes. "Forgive me. I wasn't trying to snoop. I was curious, that's all. You don't speak it often. Just a few words and only to the birds. Whispers, really." Anna still has her head bent toward the parrots. "They don't speak at all, so I hardly think a full soliloquy necessary." "Touché," Xenia says, but the corners of her pretty mouth draw in tighter. She isn't ready to give up. Anna's refusal to speak her native language is one of the main arguments flaunted by her detractors. "But you won't converse in it, or at least not with any of us. Why?" Anna is tired of debating this issue with Xenia. "The Russian was the last language I heard spoken in that house," she says, eager to bring the questioning to an end. Even with her face turned, she can see Xenia flinch. "Ekaterinburg." "Yes." "I'm sorry." Xenia is abashed. "I wasn't thinking. I mean, that never occurred to me." Anna carefully deposits the birds back in their cage and forgives her host with a smile. "People are curious. It's understandable." Xenia stares over Anna's shoulder, out the window to the tennis courts beyond. Her cool facade of disinterest is complete except for one small detail. She is wringing her hands. "Will you be staying in your rooms today?" she asks, "or would you like to join me for a round of tennis?" They have played several times since her arrival in February, but Anna lacks Xenia's height and long years of practice. Losing occasionally is fine. Losing constantly is demoralizing. "No, thank you," she says. "I might go for a walk along the beach later." A tiny flash of relief crosses Xenia's face, and therefore a thread of suspicion begins to hum at the back of Anna's mind, like an exposed wire. "Come find me when you're ready," Xenia says. "It's been weeks since I walked the harbor." "I would very much enjoy the company," Anna lies, then watches her host leave in much the way a cat would watch the parrots in her cage. Xenia is the most competitive woman she has ever known. A ruthless tennis player, a veritable card shark, a chess prodigy, a formidable equestrian. She competes in local show jumping competitions. She is a strong swimmer, a princess of European birth, thus making her the highest ranking member of her social circle, wife to an aristocrat, mother of a beautiful daughter, owner of the largest estate in Oyster Bay, driver of new cars, wearer of designer clothes, friend to few, admired by all, moneyed, titled, winner at everything she sets her mind to. And there is no reason why Xenia would relinquish an easy victory on the courts today, or any day, unless she doesn't actually want Anna to play. "Interesting," Anna mutters as she crosses the room to look at the tennis courts. They are currently empty, but Anna opens the window and settles into a large chair beside it to wait. She thumbs through her mail, deciding which letters to answer and which to toss. There are always so many. She has three from Gleb, one with the words, Urgent, please respond, scrawled on the back of the envelope. Always so dramatic, she mutters, slicing it open with her paper knife. Since his dismissal from Kenwood in February, Gleb has been on a mission to learn everything he can about the inheritance mentioned by the Romanov family in their statement to the New York Times. It was the first time they confirmed that the Tsar's rumored fortune actually exists. Such an inheritance would change Anna's life